Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, I'm Phil Bronstein. I'm editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, and welcome to the Commonwealth of California. Tonight's program with longtime Washington, D.C. journalist Joe Klein. Joe graduated from the University of Pennsylvania with a degree in American Civilization, which is a very narrow field. Joe was a contributing editor and Washington bureau chief for Rolling Stone from 1975 to 1980. He then served for 5 years as political columnist for New York Magazine, followed by a stint at Newsweek, where he wrote the column Public Lives. In January 1996, he anonymously published the novel Primary Colors, based on the 1992 Democratic presidential primary. Spent 9 weeks as number one on the New York Times bestseller list. And in December of that same year, Joe joined The New Yorker to write the Letter from Washington column. In 2000, he published The Running Mate, a sequel to Primary Colors, and he published The Natural, Bill Clinton's Misunderstood Presidency, in March 2002. In January 2003, he joined Time magazine to write a column called In the Arena. Joe is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and a former Guggenheim Fellow. He's here tonight with his new book, Politics Lost, How American Democracy Was Trivialized by People Who Think You're Stupid. Please join me in welcoming Joe Klein to the Commonwealth Club.
Thanks.
We were in the back talking, reminiscing about youth misspent in San Francisco and elsewhere. But we'll try and keep tonight's topic to serious matters of politics.
Yeah, but you became a grown-up. You're an editor.
I mean, I'm a bureaucrat. That's different.
See, I don't even have to pretend.
Journalists never have to grow up. That's why we're in this business.
I have children who are older than I am.
You know, I have some interesting questions here. One of them, it says, is Bush going to bomb Iran? Now, you were quoted, and I'm trying to find the quote here, on Stephanopoulos' show the other day. You know what I'm going to say, right?
Yes, I was
on April 16th, that regarding us dealing with Iran, we should not take any option, including the use of tactical nuclear weapons, off the table.
Yes, I said that, and it was stupid because of the context in which I said it and also in the details. First of all, I didn't put it in the proper context. I believe that, first of all, I believe that it is disastrous under almost any circumstances, except when after we've been attacked directly, it's disastrous for us to act unilaterally in the world. I've been in favor of use of force when it was done through the United Nations for a Gulf War or NATO, Kosovo, and Afghanistan. I was opposed to the war in Iraq because it wasn't done through in a multilateral context. I especially right now believe that the Bush administration has completely forfeited all international credibility when it comes to proposing the use of force because of the last 3 or 4 years. And I have for more than a decade advocated recognition of Iran diplomatically. I visited there in 2001, spent 3 weeks there. Having said all that, which I didn't say, I should have then said what I said in response to a direct question, which is that considering the situation now, all options always have to be on the table. I shouldn't have mentioned tactical nuclear weapons because that crosses a diplomatic line that you never want to go across, but I can imagine the unimaginable. I can imagine the Iranians, especially the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, buying a suitcase bomb from the former Soviet Union and detonating it somewhere, in which case a nuclear response in the context of NATO might not be unthinkable.
You know, the suggestion that I got from the quote, and I didn't see the tape, so maybe I got this wrong, was that as you said, everything should remain on the table in negotiations.
It always, you know, that's the unstated. You know, the one of the amazing things about the Bush administration is that they keep on stating what should remain unstated. Preventive war has always been a doctrine of the United States and other countries. You just don't go around saying it. You know, the use of nuclear weapons has always been an unstated possibility. You just don't go around stating it. The fact that North Korea and Iran and Iraq were not our friends was obvious, but to call them the axis of evil was counterproductive. You know, the day after Bush did that, I had just gotten back from Iran about 3 or 4 months earlier, and I got this torrent of emails from the young, the educated, the people who are our best friends over there, the people who held the vigils, the only vigils in the region after September 11th, in support of us and mourning our dead. And the emails all said the same thing. Why on earth does George W. Bush want to empower the mullahs? Well, I think that there are common, you know, there's a common interest here. The mullahs need us as an enemy to take people's minds off of the repression at home. George W. Bush needs the mullahs as an enemy to keep people's minds off of all the things that are going wrong here.
So, in other words, it works for him.
I don't think anything's working for him these days.
So, you know, you kind of demonize and also lionize to some extent consultants and the role that consultants play in politics in your book. What happened to Karl Rove? Didn't we see a documentary that talked about him as this brilliant guy?
He is a brilliant guy when it comes to running elections. I mean, he's far more brilliant than the Democrats who try to do this. You know, let me give you an example. First of all, let's put this in a little context. Politics Lost is mostly a book about presidential politics. The eight presidential campaigns I've covered, with nine kind of taxiing down the runway now. And presidential politics is different from legislative politics. It's a far more intimate office. You're inviting the person you elect into your home for the next 4 years. You're going to live in your kitchen, in your TV room, in your bedroom. And
especially in Clinton's case.
He lived in a lot of bedrooms. And so the character of the person whom you're voting for becomes far more important. Republicans from the very start, from the very first consultants who existed, of course, out here in California in the 1930s, the Republicans have always thought that that politics was about personalities and entertainment. Democrats, dating back to FDR, thought it was about policies and issues. So when Karl Rove organizes the 2000 George W. Bush campaign, he moves into a room of his colleagues and he says, there are three questions here. Who's the stronger candidate? Who's more trustworthy? Who cares more about people like me? Not about like Carl, but like you. And maybe even not about you. Since I would guess that you guys read and follow politics and stuff. I mean, so anyway, Rove then says, look, our natural strength as Republicans is strength. Our natural weakness is cares about people like me, and so we've been developing this conservative, this compassionate conservative agenda, which seems to be working with women in the suburbs. Who's more trustworthy is the battleground, and before this thing is over, no one is going to think that Al Gore is trustworthy. It was very neat. It was elegant. It was a brilliant campaign plan. What are the Democrats doing in the meantime? They're spending all their time and energy and effort trying to figure out how to come up with a prescription drug plan that labor likes and the environmentalists and the minorities, and the same is true for, you know, an environmental policy. They miss the forest for the twigs. And so that's an essential difference between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to this. The other thing I'll say about Karl Rove is this. This is the 30th anniversary of a crucial memo that was sent to Jimmy Carter by his 26-year-old pollster, Pat Caddell. This was a first. Pat Caddell, 26 years old, not a very modest guy, sent a 10,000-word memo to Jimmy Carter telling him how to govern. And in that memo, he said, you are going to have to, in order to succeed as president, you're going to have to govern as if this is a permanent campaign. A continuing campaign was his. And so the permanent campaign was born. And ever since then, the presidency has been seen through, you know, from a consultant's eye view. Now, last week, Karl Rove was removed as the guy in charge of policy in the White House. And to my mind, policy people and leaders and consultants look at the world through different ends of the telescope. Consultants, like Karl Rove, think about winning the news cycle or the message of the week, and not much farther beyond that. Leaders and policy people are supposed to look way down the road. And one of the things that we've lost in politics is the sense of distance and the sense of perspective that leaders should have. A lot of that has gone down the tubes in the service of what will work immediately now and what will boost my poll numbers right now.
You lambaste pollsters, as you're doing now in your book, and political consultants, and politicians, who you say basically are following the lead of the consultants and the pollsters. What about the people who vote for these same politicians? Because certainly the press has done enough in uncovering, you know, the ugly truth, including in anonymous primary colors, about pollsters and consultants and, you know, the ugly sausage making of politics. But at some point, it's the responsibility of voters, when they have the information, to make an intelligent decision.
Absolutely right. I named a character in Primary Colors after this concept, Orlando Ozio, the governor of New York. Machiavelli said that Ozio is the greatest enemy of a republic. What's Ozio? Ozio is Italian for indolence. Machiavelli was really concerned about how do you keep a republic coherent when it isn't in crisis, when it's not at war in times of peace. Well, we've had a pretty fabulous run of 60 years of unprecedented peace and prosperity. Yes, there have been wars, but not the kind of all-consuming war that World War II was. And during that time, I believe we've started to lose the habits of citizenship. And so there's plenty of blame to go around. But I do believe things are changing. And I think that they began to change with September 11th. But I think that we've now reached, I mean, this is a fairly hip country. People may not know the difference. In fact, most New Yorker editors, I tried this out on them in 2000. I asked them, what's the difference between George W. Bush's prescription drug plan for the elderly and Al Gore's? And nobody could tell the difference. But they can judge character, and they know what market-tested language sounds like. If a politician comes to you and says, rather than a doctrine of family values, we should have policies that value families. You know that there isn't a human being on the face of the earth who actually talks like that. You know that it's phony. And I think that, I hope that, we're reaching the point in this country where there will be a different threshold qualification for credibility as a presidential candidate. This is what I'm proposing in this book, and this is what I'm going to act on as a journalist covering, God help me, my 9th presidential campaign. And it's this. If a politician says to you things that you agree with entirely, don't believe him or her, since we may have an or her this time around. You know, for me, the threshold of credibility isn't going to be the amount of money that they've raised, which is something that we so tremendously overvalue in journalism, or their standing in the polls, or their endorsements. If a politician doesn't tell me some inconvenient truth, if he doesn't or she doesn't stand for an important policy that has less than 40% support in the polls, I'm not going to take him seriously.
So disagreement,
and I don't think you should either.
So disagreement and discomfort are the two hallmarks of who we should vote for.
Absolutely, because everybody knows. Everybody, you know, George Bush is standing at 32 or 33% in the polls right now, and he got there the old-fashioned way. He earned it. People know that this country is in trouble. They know that we're in trouble overseas. And they suspect that there are big things happening here. They suspect that given 40 days of rain in San Francisco, a kind of biblical number, that there is climate change going on. And those who are our age know that our big, fat, self-indulgent baby boom generation is going to retire, and we're going to live to be about 367, and our kids are going to have to pay for it. I think that, you know, we're at a point now where the folks are ready to be tougher on politicians and maybe pay a little bit more attention. Now,
any evidence of that, by the way?
Any evidence?
Yeah.
Yeah, look at the polls. Bush is at 32, 70. In the Wall Street Journal poll today, more than 70% of the people say the country's on the wrong track.
But don't we keep every election year writing about the fact that polls are invalid and the polls are wrong and they always get things wrong, and people who tank in the polls get reelected? It's astonishing. It's like ex-felons. They can somehow get into office.
They're not wrong when they're 70-30. I mean, I'll believe any 80-20 poll. You know, I believe that by 80-20, the public was against the Dubai ports deal. I think they were wrong, but that was the way they felt.
Well, you know, Schwarzenegger's not doing too well in the polls, but here's the problem there, and I guess this is also the issue with George Bush, although he's a lame duck president, which is who's running against him?
Right.
And who's running against Schwarzenegger will probably be the real issue about whether Arnold Schwarzenegger gets reelected, not what his poll standing is.
And you know, that goes to the 2004 election, which was, you know, what sent me scurrying off to my computer to write this book. It was a one-sentence election. You know, Kerry's sentence was, I voted for the $87 billion before I voted against it. And Bush's sentence was, you may not always agree with me, but you'll always know where I stand. Now, that was like the most perfectly focused group sentence imaginable. I'll do a translation. First half of the sentence, you may not always agree with me. Privately, Karl Rove is going, oh, my God, they don't like anything we're doing. They hate the war. They hate the economy. So what do? You may not always agree with me. Second half of the sentence, but they can't stand the other guy either. He's a flip-flopper. He's a windsurfer. But you'll always know where I stand. Hence, the winning sentence in the election. And how pathetic is it that at a moment of real import in our country, that an election which drew an awful lot of interest, 62% of the people actually went out and voted, which is still pathetic, but it's much better than last time, how pathetic is it that sentence, you know, my policies may suck, but the other guy is a windsurfer. How pathetic is it that that's what decides it?
Well, you don't think that some of those issues, including an entertainment factor, existed historically and have existed historically? I mean, Abraham Lincoln managed his image brilliantly.
Absolutely. I think that, and I'm not saying that these things shouldn't exist. Part of politics has to be entertainment. You know, if you're going to listen to, say, Bill Bradley deliver his health care plan, it's real tough. It's very hard. But I think that what's changed in the 37 years that I've done this is that the consultants have drained a lot of the spontaneity and humanity out of the process. Can I tell a story, the story that opens the book? On the night that Martin Luther King was assassinated, Robert Kennedy was beginning his presidential campaign in Indiana, and he was scheduled to give a speech at a rally that night in the ghetto in Indianapolis. He lands in Indianapolis. The local police chief, who improbably named Winston Churchill, tells him that the Indianapolis police aren't going to protect him because they're going to protect the white neighborhoods because they assume the blacks are going to go rioting. Kennedy doesn't have any Secret Service. His staff says, don't go in there. Kennedy says, I'm going in there. Now, this is before the era of cell phones. Few of us remember that. And so the crowd, which has been gathered there for an hour or two, doesn't know about Martin Luther King's death yet. Kennedy's speechwriter, Adam Walensky, has written up some talking points, and Kennedy just goes like this to Walensky. I don't need him. He gets up, very softly and calmly announces that Martin Luther King has been murdered in Memphis by a white man. I recommend to all of you that you listen to this 4.5 minutes of tape. You can hear it on the internet. The crowd responds with these incredible cries of anguish. Kennedy starts speaking very calmly and talking about how Martin Luther King was about love and not about hate, and about compassion and not about anger. And as he's feeling his way into this audience, he mentions, to the amazement of his staff, that a member of his family was killed, but he was killed by a white man, he says. And Kennedy has never talked in public about the death of his brother or in private to his staff until that moment. Feeling his way farther, he understands that he's got him. The quality, you can hear the quality of the silence on the tape. And then he quotes Aeschylus, his favorite poet, about pain which falls drop by drop upon the heart until wisdom comes in our sleep through the awful grace of God. Now, that could not happen today. First of all, Aeschylus would never survive a focus group. Second of all, Kennedy would know too damn much about the audience because his pollsters would have brought him all the numbers. The Baptists in Indianapolis are opposed to gay marriage by 70 to 30, and the Methodists are against abortion by 60-40. The top three issues are health, education, and jobs. The bottom three issues are this, this, and this. And here are some phrases that we've tested in our focus groups that might be more efficient, you know, when you're talking to them. What was wonderful about that moment was Kennedy's ignorance. The fact that he only knew that they were poor, they were angry, and possibly violent. And he was able, because of his lack of knowledge, his humanity took over. Now, moments like that are rare. They always were. You know, they weren't the coin of the realm in American politics, but they have become almost impossible to happen now. And that's my lament, and that's why I wrote the book.
Do you think that Robert Kennedy, if he had been running for office today, would have done the same thing, or would he have listened to the pollsters and the consultants?
I think he would have. You know, I have sufficient respect for the memory of Robert Kennedy, especially the knowledge through suffering that he gained after the death of his brother. In fact, knowledge through suffering is a pretty good attribute for a president. Franklin Roosevelt was probably an awful lot like George H.W. Bush before he got polio. But I think that Kennedy would have tried. He would have gone into Indianapolis under similar circumstances. But because of all the information at his disposal, it could never have been as spontaneous. And so that's what I think that we've lost.
Well, I mean, you say that about that particular anecdote in your book was one of the last truly courageous and spontaneous acts by an American politician. And what I immediately thought of was, well, Lyndon Johnson, who wasn't necessarily spontaneous, was responsible for the passage of civil rights legislation that was landmark.
No,
that was an act of courage, no matter how you slice it.
Listen, there have been plenty of acts of courage in the presidency since then. I'm talking about acts of spontaneity and humanity in the process, which are the moments that most of us use to gauge who this person who's going to be living in our bedroom is. And those are the things that have been diminished. Look, I would say, you know, you may disagree with George W. Bush's policies, But more than almost any other politician I've covered in the last decade, this is a guy who does not govern by the polls. You know, his position on immigration right now is not a very popular one if you look at the numbers. His desire to reform Social Security a year ago was not a very popular one. And if he watched the polls, he'd be skedaddling out of Iraq right now. But whether you like it or not, he's a guy who believes what he believes.
So he's following your advice, in other words.
Yes.
Okay. I'm sure he'll be pleased to know that. You know, you talked about the Robert Kennedy moment. It was the last moment before American political life was overwhelmed by marketing professionals, consultants, and pollsters who have robbed public life of much of its romance and vigor. What about political pundits?
Oh, we're awful. You know,
I mean, isn't part of your job essentially to tell people what to think?
Yes, and there are ways to do that are educational, and ways to do it that are harmful. Here are the things that I won't do. First of all, I recognize what most of my colleagues don't recognize, which is that we're getting our information that pretty much the same way that pollsters and marketing consultants are. We're looking in the rearview mirror. We're judging the next campaign by the last campaign. And so I hate making predictions. I can't stand it. And in fact, I'll make some broad observations about the sort of thing that I think is going to happen. But most of the columns that I write are about issues, things going on right now, or evaluations of a politician's position on this issue or what he or she is saying on the stump. You know, I'll say, and one of the dangerous things I do, and one of the most dangerous things you can do as a political reporter now, is occasionally I'll praise a politician for his or her position on an issue. I mean, that's the toughest story to write. Because our skepticism, our natural skepticism, has slipped into cynicism. It's really safe. I mean, you know, there's always that. One consultant, Mike Murphy, said to me, he's a Republican, he said, I'd hate to think of what your reaction would be to Lincoln's Gettysburg Address right now. You know, the second paragraph would be the standard second paragraph, cynical second paragraph in any news story, which is the president, Lincoln's aide said that the speech was an attempt to win over the veterans' vote and an experiment with a new, shorter speaking style. Now, we do that all the time.
There was criticism then of the speech.
Sure. But nowadays, it was probably substantive criticism. Nowadays, and it was also theater criticism. It wasn't that it was as gorgeous and rhetorically ornate as Edward Everett's speech before him. But there are times when politicians take positions, believe it or not, because they actually believe in them. And so I conducted an experiment in 2000 when I was covering the election for The New Yorker. I had been accused of being in the tank to Bill Clinton in 1992 because I wrote some favorable things about some of his policies and unfavorable things about other of his policies. And I wasn't accused in the tank of being in the tank there. But in 2000, I wound up being accused in print of being in the tank to George W. Bush because I was a fan of his faith-based social programs. I've written a 7,000-word piece in The New Yorker about him. I like him. I was accused of being in the tank to Bill Bradley because I liked his universal health care plan. I was accused of being in the tank to John McCain because we all were accused of being in the tank to John McCain. And I failed because I wasn't accused of being in the tank to Al Gore. And if I had known that he had given the one global warming speech that I describe in this book that his consultants totally undermined, I would have been accused of being in a tank to him, too.
Well, were you in the tank to anyone? Because we talked a little bit in the back about the seductive nature of politics, and you've actually written and spoken about that, you know, that you wanted to be in the center of things to see what it was like, and of course it's far more complex than any of us imagine from the outside, but it's a very seductive thing to be in.
I was in the tank to Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was my mentor and to whom I've dedicated this book. For the others, some I love personally. I loved Bob Kerry personally as a politician, and he's now a good friend of mine. He married my wife's cousin. I mean, these things are unavoidable. But I also loved him for his attitude. But I criticized him pretty strongly. And all of the people that I've been accused of being in the tank to are people who I've also criticized on other issues or more generally. Obviously, George W. Bush doesn't think I'm in the tank to him now.
You know, getting to the anonymous sources. At the time, you were really criticized, and your critics, because you kept insisting that you weren't the one. I saw some stuff. There was a piece in Salon that I'm sure you may or may not. I don't know if you remember or not. That you lied to his workmates, to his friends, and to the public he professes to serve. That you issued a blistering attack on Jacob Weisberg, political writer for New York Magazine, insisting that you weren't the guy when he said you were the guy, and also Donald Foster. You said you'd stake your journalistic credibility on your statement that you weren't anonymous. And on CBS News, you said to the audience, "It's not me." Now, in a time when journalists are constantly getting criticized appropriately for not being able to get the truth right or even the facts right, do you have any second thoughts about it?
No. I do have a few. One, but in general, no. Anonymous authors are different from anonymous sources. You talked about anonymous sources going in. Anonymity is one of the oldest and most honored traditions, literary traditions. I was following that tradition. If at any point I thought that my anonymity would hurt another person, I would have come out. If at any point my boss, Maynard Parker, the editor of Newsweek, had asked me to come out, I would have come out. Now, what happened was this. I made some mistakes. After a New York Magazine piece by this guy, Donald Foster, who accused me of being a racist and a homophobe, identified me as the author of the book, I chose, for a number of reasons, some of which are quite personal and involve my family, not to come out. That was a big mistake. And after that, I figured the only way to have any credibility at all was to be obnoxious about it and to say the sort of things that I said, all of which were overboard. Now, Jacob Weisberg, whom I exploded at that night, has since become a really good friend of mine. And I didn't, you know, in the end, I learned a couple of things. First of all, I learned how difficult it is to think clearly when you're under pressure. When I finally was outed, you know, first of all, I wasn't thinking very clearly when I had to make the choice about New York Magazine, but 3 months later when I was outed by the Washington Post, I hold this press conference, and all of a sudden, I knew most of the people in the room, they're all screaming and yelling at me and acting as if I were an axe murderer. And that night, I couldn't sleep, and I couldn't eat, and my hands were shaking, and I kept on drinking water and going to the bathroom, and I realized at a certain point, Joe, what you've just experienced, is an average day in the life of Bill Clinton. And I realized that the kind of atmosphere that we impose on politicians is unfair. And so I changed my ground rules as a journalist, or at least one very basic one. I instituted a no gotcha rule, that if a politician said something dumb to me that didn't involve a matter of national import, he or she could take it back. And I will tell them this going in, because I don't need to make my name on momentary slips of the tongue of politicians. The other thing so I think it made me a better journalist. Also gave me my second novel, which was The Running Mate, which was about a politician trying to be a human being in the middle of a campaign in that he falls in love with a woman who hates politics. But was it awkward? Yeah. Was I an axe murderer? No. Was the response of journalists who mistook fiction for journalism disproportionate? Yeah, I think it was. I think one of the things that people, that the public is upset with us about isn't so much our lack of credibility, although they are worried about that. But especially in those days, they were kind of nonplussed when we would take little things like an anonymous novel and blow them up into major scandals, or little things like late night pizza delivery in the White House and blow that up into an impeachment proceeding. I think that in the 90s we went a little nuts and lost our sense of proportion.
You're talking about the press.
What?
Press?
Absolutely.
You know, you were pretty hard on Clinton, I think, in the book, even though it was fictionalized. And you hit him a number of times. Do you at any point in, or have you at any point in the last number of months, felt like saying, come back, Bill, all is forgiven, we miss you?
I've been feeling that way throughout. I mean, listen, during the years after Primary Colors, I was one of Clinton's main defenders. I defended him with Monica Lewinsky. You know, the week that the Lewinsky scandal broke in the New Yorker, I wrote the comment, and I said that this is an era that's going to be remembered more for the ferocity of its prosecutions than for the severity of its crimes, and such eras are never remembered very fondly. Clinton gave me probably more time than any other journalist, because he knew I was with him on the substance of much of his administration, especially when he resumed being a New Democrat after his first 2 years in office. He gave me a number of hours of interviews as he was leaving, which became my book, The Natural, which, you know, came out of a long profile that I did in The New Yorker. And he and I speak fairly frequently. We've even spoken about Primary Colors a couple of times.
What does he say about it?
Well, he never says very much about anything that I ever wrote, but there was this one thing I did say to him was that, in my mind, the gimmick in Primary Colors was going to be that Governor Jack Stanton, would lose. But he just wouldn't lose. I kept on throwing all these terrible problems his way, and he kept on figuring out his way around them. And Clinton sent me a really wonderful note saying that he was, you know, thrilled that I had allowed Jack Stanton to win. But the other moment was really kind of weird. It was after a long interview that he and I did about health care and welfare in the course of these New Yorker interviews. And Mrs. Clinton came in. The three of us are sitting there having a Diet Coke, and he says to me, so why did you write that other book anyway? And I said, well, Mr. President, I saw it as a tribute to larger-than-life politicians, which was indeed the truth. At which point, the First Lady snorted derisively. And I said, no, First Lady, would you rather have a larger-than-life president or a smaller-than-life president? And at that point, she was very much looking at the possibility of George W. Bush or Al Gore, and so she shrugged in acquiescence. And I said, you know, larger-than-life politicians have larger-than-life strengths and larger-than-life weaknesses. And she looked at me, and she looked at her husband, and she said, that's for sure.
If you were looking at Hillary Clinton today, how would you assess her? Is she a larger-than-life personality? Is she a viable candidate?
Well, she's certainly a viable candidate, but she's not a larger-than-life personality. And, you know, one of the bright-line tests that I have for politicians is whether or not they're whether or not they're confident enough in their own intelligence to think in my presence. Now, Bill Clinton always passed that test, always. Few others do. Some do on some issues and not on others. Al Gore would pass that test when he and I were talking about the environment or about military policy. Hillary, I've found, very, very forthcoming in private, but If you think about the parameters I've set down for myself for 2008, she's very controlled. She's never very spontaneous. I think she's going to have problems. What I suspect may happen is this, that she'll come, and this gets pretty close to a prediction, but not really that close. I suspect she'll come roaring into Iowa in 2008, kind of the way Howard Dean did in 2004, you know, with a lot of cash and a lot of endorsements and strong poll numbers. And then, for 3 weeks, we'll have an election. And the people in Iowa will look at her, and they will ask her questions, and they'll make judgments. And one of the very big questions that they'll ask her, that she's going to need an answer for, and it's a very hard one to answer, is, what's he going to do? What's his job? You know, you did health care for him. What's he going to do for you? And that'll be a big problem. And the other kind of subliminal problem that she'll have is this. The folks out in Iowa are very, very fair-minded and kind of populist. And they're going to be asking, why is it that we are trading our most precious public position, the presidency of the United States, back and forth between these two defective families? So,
it's been true in other countries. Why not?
So I think that you know, she may well win the nomination. She may well pass all of these tests, but these are going to be difficult tests, and she's going to have to pass them, I think.
That's kind of a prediction. You mentioned Howard Dean. His moment of exuberance on the campaign trail didn't exactly speak to your notion of the value of spontaneity.
Well, listen, you know, spontaneity, there are plenty of downsides to spontaneity, and they still exist because politicians make mistakes. I voted for it before I voted against it. It was a spontaneous moment. You won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore. It was a spontaneous moment. But very rarely do you
see... And he came back, by the way.
And he did. But very rarely do you see spontaneous moments on the upside anymore. They're almost always mistakes. My feeling about Dean was that he came close. You know, I have a whole chapter in this book about mavericks, and I'm a sucker for mavericks, mostly because they speak English, which, you know, it's really amazing to watch some of these guys, like the senators in particular. Bob Dole was a wonderful man, but in 1980, I was out in New Hampshire with him, and this little girl, she was like in fifth or sixth grade, you know, raises her hand and says, "Senator Dole, what are you going to do about acid rain?" And he says to her, "That bill's in markup." I mean, you know, Dean spoke English, and he also had the virtue of being right about the war. He was right about Iraq. In fact, my friend Elaine Kmark said that the reason why he was right about Iraq probably was that he was the only one of the Democratic candidates who didn't get a confidential intelligence briefing from the CIA. The problem with Howard Dean was the problem that mavericks have and the reason why consultants are absolutely necessary. He got caught up in himself and in the campaign. The campaign was, you may recall, a really wonderful, euphoric thing. I loved going to Dean meetings. Those folks were actually doing things in their neighborhoods, trying to improve the life in their neighborhoods. But when Howard Dean would speak to them, and he was kind of nonplussed by these crowds, the campaign became a campaign about the campaign. It became, isn't this a terrific crowd? Aren't we wonderful? And the moment that it really hit home to me was when he spoke at Cooper Union in New York from the same podium from which Abraham Lincoln delivered one of his great speeches, "A House Divided Against Itself Cannot Stand." And from Lincoln's day till now, politicians will go to Cooper Union and they'll give posterity their best shot. Howard Dean went there and announced that he was busting out of the federal campaign finance laws. His campaign had become a campaign about process rather than substance. And that's why I think in the end it failed. Plus, he was a pretty angry guy.
Yeah. You have argued both in your columns and in your book for the politics of sanity, what you call the politics of sanity. Pragmatism, centrism is the only hope for politics, you know, drag itself out of this muck that you describe, versus a party of passion, if I'm understanding your argument. But you also talk about this kind of spontaneity and this speaking from the heart as the saving grace of politicians in the past, like Bobby Kennedy. You know, how do you reconcile those things?
You can have passionate sanity. I mean, I figure that when I write my memoir, it's going to be called Flaming Moderate. But look, you know, let's analyze this for a second. For the last 6 years, George W. Bush has tried to govern from the right, and he has failed miserably. I think that an attempt to govern from the left would fail just as miserably. My mentor, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, used to say to me that if you really want to make a big change, in fact, he said this was in the context of the Hillary's health care plan in 1994. He said, you got to create something that's going to have 75 to 80 votes in the Senate. You can't pass universal health insurance with 51 votes. The nature of the government, the nature of the democracy won't allow that. And so we got some huge things on the table now. We have to pass a universal health care plan, which I suspect will be a lot like the one that Mitt Romney just passed in Massachusetts. We have to pass an alternative energy plan that deals with global warming and our national security problems. We have to deal with our, you know, baby boom retirement and a bunch of other things as well. My guess is that ain't going to happen with a president who's trying to govern from his base. So that's pragmatic, but there's a certain amount of passion in there because I really believe that right now, in this transition from the industrial age to the information age, we owe our citizens a new information age social safety net. We owe it to ourselves, and we owe a more rational foreign policy to the rest of the world.
You know, you use the word populism as a thing that shouldn't exist in politics, not a positive force in politics. Is that accurate?
Yeah,
I think the population that makes up some degree.
I know
populism.
It's odd for someone who once wrote a biography of Woody Guthrie to feel this way,
right.
But if you look at the history of populism in this country, and I'd recommend to everybody that if you haven't read C. Van Woodward's biography of Tom Watson, the Georgia populist, you should. I mean, it starts off with some good ideas, but it's always grounded in hatred. Almost always grounded in hatred. Tom Watson started off high-minded and wound up being the most vicious racist and anti-Semite in the South. Same was true of George Wallace, who was another form of populist. I was doing a radio show today, and some caller said, isn't the real story here the contest between corporate greed and human need? And I said, I'll go with you on the human need part of it. And I'll even agree with you that over the last 25, 30 years, corporations have had an unnatural impact on legislation, and especially during the last 6 years. But we need corporations. You know, in a free economy, they are what create prosperity, which creates jobs, which produce produce the tax revenues that enable us to help the least of these, which is what we should be doing as a society. So I'm a populist in a way, but without the angry rhetoric. You know, I wish we could just stow all this anger. You know, anger has become this ridiculous media commodity. It isn't our fault, us print guys.
Thanks.
It's you know, cable news. I mean, there's a whole generation of Americans who think that political discourse is Eleanor Clift and Pat Buchanan yelling at each other. And that's tremendously unfortunate.
Yeah, but what it is it's entertaining.
It
is. I think there's an entertainment factor and a personality factor in politics that has been a factor in politics and successful politics forever. And the reality is that, you know, if you're entertaining, There was a dinner I went to years ago in Southern California. Norman Lear was there, and his wife, who's a political activist in the Democratic Party, and Larry David and his wife, who's an activist in the Democratic Party, and Mickey Cantor from the Clinton administration. All these Democrats sitting around going, oh, the world is over. Rupert Murdoch runs the media. George Bush is president. We're all finished. Yeah. And I'm looking at this guy, Norman Lear, his finger on the pulse of American culture for, 25 years, brilliantly, people with a lot of money and a big issue of entertainment in their background, and they can't figure out why, the Republicans put on Bill O'Brien and Rush Limbaugh, who, after all, if you ignore what they're saying, if you don't agree, are very fun and entertaining, and the Democrats put up Andrea Dworkin to respond. What's wrong with that picture?
What's wrong with that picture is this. Look, we're always going to have bread and circuses. There was a time and when you could have really entertaining political discourse and argument that was also kind of responsible. You know, Bill Buckley's old show Firing Line, which was on PBS, was pretty damn contentious, but it was responsible. And I would also go so far as to say that Bill Clinton was pretty damn entertaining, and he was even more. He was most entertaining when he was trying to explain something complicated to the folks. Because you remember what he'd do? All of a sudden, he'd start to get a little bit more folksy if he was like talking about free trade to a union audience, and he'd drape his arms over the podium. You remember how he did it with those big hands, those big arms, and he'd get this aw shucks thing going, and you couldn't not listen to him. I think it's possible to have entertaining political discourse without two nitwits screaming at each other.
So the entertainment factor would be what exactly?
The entertainment factor would be clever, funny, intelligent people debating each other.
Well, there's a far smaller pool of those people.
I know, but, we could kind of try and cultivate that pool. What we're doing right now is driving them out of public life.
You know, you wrote a while ago that both parties seem zealously intent on ignoring the common good. Who exactly determines the common good?
The people. I think that there is a general feeling in the public right now, and it's a correct one, that the stuff that these folks are spending their time on in Washington aren't the things that they should be. Terry Schiavo, I don't believe, is at the top of the agenda for most people. And the other thing is this. As a flaming moderate, I've latched on over the years to flaming moderate politicians who are the glue in Washington, who create the compromises. And there's been way serious attrition among those people, far more serious than among the hyper-partisans on the left and the right, who in truth represent maybe, according to Pew polling, 15% of the left, 15% of the population on the left and 15% of the population on the right. There's 70% of us who might be leaning left or right, but we're essentially in the middle. But the guys and the women who are moderates in Washington leave because of the prospect that a vicious partisan is going to run against them in the next election and throw up 30-second ads that completely distort their positions on this, that, or the other thing. And I will give you the example of Max Cleland, who was one of my favorites, being a Vietnam combat veteran. I really liked the six Vietnam combat veterans who served in the Senate in the 90s. and his opponent put an ad up, comparing him to Osama bin Laden. Now, I kind of fault Cleland for not coming back, and I have the ad. I don't know why he didn't use it. Why didn't Max Cleland have an ad with him sitting in a wheelchair with only his, I guess it's his left hand, with a clicker, and he clicks on a TV, and the ad comparing him to Osama bin Laden starts. And he lets the public watch it, and then he clicks it off. And why didn't he just say, how can the people of Georgia ever even consider sending a person to the United States Senate who would put garbage like that on the air? I think that I think that, now that would be fun. That would be entertaining.
Entertaining, yes.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, this stuff doesn't have to be dull. It can be entertaining, and I'm not opposed to political attack. I think that political attack is part of the process. And you know, one of the things we really need to see is how politicians respond to being attacked. If a politician has a glass jaw, you're not going to want him or her as your president.
So essentially your view is that we're kind of in the Roman amphitheater portion of our political culture, and at some point there'll be a backlash.
Listen, all I'm saying is that we need a recalibration. I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel here. I mean, there are always going to be consultants. There's always going to be negative ads, although I suspect now, since the invention of the clicker, those ads have less utility than they once did. Although the consultants will be the last ones to admit that, because that's where they make all their money, right? But I do believe at this point, one small calibration that might well be made profitably by politicians is telling us an occasional thing we don't want to hear.
There's a question about John McCain. Is John McCain a man of inviolate principle, or rather willing to compromise principle to further his aspiration?
Well, he's had a lousy couple of months. I don't mind his going down to Liberty University to commune with Jerry Falwell's folks. In fact, I really thought, and I say in the book, that John Kerry should have followed the advice of his staff members as opposed to his consultants, who kept on telling him to go to places like Liberty University, go to the Southern Baptist Convention, confront those people, show your strength by taking their most hostile questions and by saying to them, look, there are going to be things I disagree with you on, but there are some things that the members of your that I'm in favor of, that the members of your congregation really may want and need. So I have no problem with McCain on that. Where I do have a problem, and I wrote about it and I ripped him up in my column about this, was fiscal responsibility was one of the pillars of John McCainism. He voted against the Bush tax cuts, which was an act of real courage. And now, all of a sudden, he's voting for the Bush tax cuts. And his rationale when I asked him was, since the cuts he voted to extend the Bush tax cuts. His rationale was that if he voted against the extension, he would be voting for a tax increase. Now, McCain and I both have 20-year-old daughters, and they're wild girls, and we've been comparing notes on them, for at least the last 7 years. And I said to him, it may be a tax increase you may have voted against a tax increase for people who are paying taxes now, but you certainly voted for a tax increase for your daughter Megan and my daughter Sophie and our kids. If he's going to violate, his standard core beliefs in order to appeal to the right wing of the Republican Party, A, it ain't going to work, and B, I'm going to be really skeptical about his candidacy.
We've got a couple minutes. This has gone by far faster than I thought. But I'm a print guy, so, time is important.
Me too.
One of the questions that that a number of people asked, and I was going to ask you, was about, I was going to actually quote from a blog critic of yours, but I'll spare you that and just ask you for a brief answer on what the role you think a new media is going to play in politics, blogging being among them.
I think that it's going to play an increasingly important role. I read the blogs every day. I would hope that the bloggers would be more responsible than they've been. I would hope that they try actually picking up the phone every once in a while if they're going to attack someone like me or anybody else and say, hey, what did you mean when you said that? I would hope that the intemperate tone, especially on the left, left-wing bloggers are kind of like right-wing radio talk show hosts, I would hope that that would moderate a little bit. The response to the intemperance on the right is understandable, but I think it's going to be counterproductive.
We've got 1 minute, and since there was one question here that was not about national policy, a lot of questions, like, what's wrong with the Democrats? But I think we've addressed that a fair amount. But this is a local one. Mayor Gavin Newsom claims that his issuance of marriage license to gay couples had no effect on the 2004 election. And I will add to the question, despite the fact that it was raised all over the country by the Republicans, what do you think?
Oh, I think that he broke the law, and it did have an impact. I speak as someone who is having an engagement party for a gay friend of mine this summer on Cape Cod. I'm in favor of gay people doing whatever they want to do. I see them as my equal in every way, shape, and form. But I think that something like marriage is also a legal state, and if you're going to do what he did, it has to be done in a legal context.
That's the flaming moderate part of your position.
Yeah.
Okay. Unfortunately, that's...
It's the flambeau moderate part of my position.
We've reached the end of the program, and now I realize I was supposed to keep saying during the course of the program you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, but... I blew that one. But our thanks to Joe Klein. Thank you for all your questions. I'm sorry I didn't get to all of them. Yes, give yourselves and Joe a hand.
Thank you very much.
Now, I have to get this in. Wait, so we also thank our audience here and on the radio. I'm Phil Bronstein. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, don't forget Joe's book, by the way, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.